This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to Podcast Deluxe, your I'm About to Sin Again of Weekly Cultural Review. I am John Caramonica.
I'm Joe Coscarelli.
We are back. It's episode 7. We are going to talk about everything that is popping, extremely popping.
Yeah.
Slapping this week. It was a very challenging week in pop culture. So there was some action that happened this week. There were some tensions. There were some fraught moments. So we're going to get into a bunch of it. We're going to talk Britney and Victor.
Yeah.
This is.
Unfortunately.
It's tough. We're going to talk some Taylor songwriting, subject matter, rewrites. Don't rewrite. We are going to talk Lil Uzi Vert.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to talk Lil Wes Anderson.
Lil Wes.
Tiny Lil Wes. Young Wes Anderson. We got snacks. We got a lot going on. I do want to say there are t-shirts and there are stickers. It's the podcast.myshopify.com. Also the t-shirt. Go ahead and grab those before there's none left above my refrigerator at home.
Kids, ask your uncles about the logo.
Seriously, that's actually true. Ask Earl Sweatshirt about the logo. He knows it. Joe, sometimes a news cycle, an arc, starts, grows, peaks, fades, disappears in between the release of one episode of Podcast Deluxe and the recording of the subsequent episode. I feel like that's what happened with the Britney Spears situation. Should we explain exactly what went on?
Do the words summer league mean anything to you?
They do, but only because I cannot reasonably come to Podcast Deluxe sitting on these beautiful chairs across from you without at least a working understanding of NBA prospects.
Right.
So that's where I'm at.
And Victor Wembanyama, the biggest NBA prospect since LeBron James.
And also the biggest NBA.
And the tallest. Yeah.
Definitely.
7'5" in shoes. Ish, although like sometimes he's next to people who are also in the 7 foot range and you're like, he's way taller than
them.
I think this is relevant because I think this is how Britney Spears A, knew who he was, and B, recognized him at the Aria Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, where he was set to play his first ever game as the NBA's number one draft pick. It happened a couple weeks ago.
How good is he?
Okay, this is for a different podcast.
But it is, but like
I am a Wemby skeptic,
ooh,
which is
interesting.
Puts me out on a limb. People think he should be the next great NBA player.
Yeah.
It is very difficult and demanding to play against Joel Embiid, Giannis Antetokounmpo, et cetera, et cetera. I think we'll see. Look, I wish the guy the best. He seems like a very bright, put together, self possessed 19-year-old, but we'll see.
Okay, so the one thing we learned about him this past week is his D is not that great because someone else had to play D around him.
Yes,
when Britney Spears ran up on him. So just for a little bit of context, you can see the video on TMZ.
It's an upsetting video on a lot of levels.
So, okay, let's talk about what's depicted in the video and then let's talk about what's implied in the video. What you see in the video, it's filmed by just a
bystander.
A bystander from distance, Britney Spears. From the back.
Unmistakable.
Definitely Britney Spears calling after Victor.
Also unmistakable.
Yes. but not using his name, but calling after him and running up, and jogging slowly.
Yeah.
And then doing this.
Yeah. Sir, sir. Yeah.
In a British accent.
In a British accent.
And then doing this as if to tap. Yep. You don't really see if the hand touches him, but what you do see is there's a security guard behind him to the right who goes like this.
Swats the hand away.
Swats it away, and then Brittany's hand seems to hit her. Like, she seems to hit her in the face.
Yeah, it's some combination of Brittany's arm and the security guard's arm make contact with Brittany's face, and you hear an audible little smack.
And then the sort of fallout in the video is Brittany has to gather herself. Victor continues. They're going into catch.
Catch, yeah.
They're going to catch.
You ever eat at catch?
Nah, bro.
Yeah, but maybe someday we'll go to catch.
That talk about snack reviews. Yeah. Okay, we're going to catch.
On location at catch.
They continue to go into catch. Brittany has to gather herself. She's with her team. They then go through some side exit. I don't know. Maybe
they are also going to eat at catch.
Right, but somehow they don't go in the same door. Yeah. There's some side thing they do. She's distraught, needs to be comforted.
She screams.
Yes.
She says something. Yeah, she says, that's America for you.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So that's what's depicted in the video.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what we're not, like, what are we presuming slash not seeing?
It's a couple things, because this also came to the public in steps and in stages. Yes. And the initial report from TMZ was that she had been knocked to the ground, sending her glasses flying with a closed fist.
Right. Which sounds horrific.
Horrific. Yeah. And obviously Brittany has been through a lot. No one wants to see her on the floor, either accidentally or otherwise. And then you have Victor being interviewed about it at practice. He gives an account. He says he was grabbed from behind by someone. He didn't know who it was. Britney Spears until later. He uses the term grabbed, which I think it's important to note, again, that English is not his first language. It was a chaotic scene. He says he had been told by security not to stop for any fans or anything, that they needed to get where they were going. To catch. Reservation. Yeah.
Resi alert.
Yeah. And, be like, and look, this is this guy's first week being extremely internationally famous. People have known who he was. Like, when was the first time you heard the name Victor Wembanyama?
Probably. I had heard the name last year, but I think really probably 2 weeks before the draft.
Right. So he's just arriving in America. Yeah. He's stunned. He's 19 years old, which means he was born after the year 2000.
Yeah.
He missed Britney Spears.
Yes. He was born after Baby One More Time.
In France.
That song was popular in France. I'm sure.
But work with me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Sorry if that's not convenient for your thesis.
No, I don't have a thesis. It's just the Britney does not mean the same thing to us as she means to 19-year-old Victor Wembanyama.
But here's the thing that really, really struck me about the video. Sorry, no pun. But here's what I noted about the video. There was a 3 or 4 year stretch where no person on the planet was more famous than Britney Spears.
Yeah.
No person on the planet was more surveilled than Britney Spears.
Right.
And by extension, and you see this in some, especially some of the recent documentaries and sort of like meta slash post coverage of Britney Spears, how anxiety inducing that level of attention was.
Yeah. Her personal space was constantly being violated.
Constantly. That said, Britney Spears, still very famous.
Yeah.
And I think probably still views herself as a famous person who can move through spaces in ways that feel right. Where you're running up against is the new Britney Spears. Obviously, he's famous in a different way. He's famous at a slightly different level, but the level of protection around him is probably not that different from the level of protection that a pop star of Britney Spears caliber would have, even walking through the lobby of a hotel. And so that intersection of I'm moving through space, they're moving through space, I feel like I can rupture that barrier. That's where the fundamental misunderstanding is.
And it does seem like a big misunderstanding, I think. Huge. What happens then is Britney posts on Instagram. She talks about this traumatic event. She demands an apology. Mm-hmm. The next day, the video leaks.
And there's a police report.
There's a police report that comes out. And the police basically tell the story of this misunderstanding, where they meet with Britney and her manager, as well as two members of her security team, who say to the police, Victor Wembanyama's security guard acted as anyone would
do. As security guards do.
Right. Seemingly not knowing who it was.
It did not, in the video, does not appear. The person seems to just be reacting.
Yeah.
Not looking and seeing and saying, is this person a threat? Not a threat. Is this person famous? Not based. Just a nuisance is how it seems.
Yes. But what's been really interesting to watch is that people can't really let it go. Britney's fans, who are understandably protective of her, given the circumstances of the last decade plus, you know, the conservatorship, et cetera, feel that she is in fact owed an apology, even if she may have violated his space initially. There's some grappling over whether she grabbed or tapped him, which I think, again, probably a little bit beside the point.
I think it's, it's not material.
Given what was happening in the moment. Mm-hmm. And then Victor has his debut. This happened on Friday, I believe, in the game. And iffy performance. I'm not going to say that proves my theory. Wow. Summer League is not, it's tough and it's not always representative. But there's one particular moment where he gets pretty brutally dunked on. And of course, the fans like that.
Right to work.
Go right to work and lay a Britney Spears song over it. Look, he hasn't apologized. People are yelling after him.
In the police report, doesn't not say that the two sides, I don't know if it was him and
Britney. His security guard came over to her table at the restaurant. They apologized to one another, according to police interviews with her team, and that they thought the situation had been squashed. Look, I think if she feels like she was humiliated in the press because of this, that opens all sorts of wounds for somebody who has been very historically mistreated by the press. But this is a hard welcome to America for this French teenager.
Right.
This is going to follow him.
That was my next question, which is if we're already on game one of the summer league before his rookie season, and he's already been memed, he got posterized, then got memed, right?
Yeah.
Are we going to be 10 years from now? He's on his fifth all-star season or something, and people are still going to be playing like opposing teams are replaying baby one more time every time he like gets the ball.
Welcome to the USA. I mean, he has to do something preferably quickly to supersede this in the public imagination.
Is he going to play Crimea River?
Oh, no. I bet you he knows who Justin Timberlake is.
I'm sorry. Forgive me in advance if that idea was not already out in the world. But sometimes you come to Podcast Deluxe for ideas that have not yet been put in the world, and now they need to be put in the world. I wonder if there's a 2.0, not simply for him, but also for Britney. Because I think you're right. The fans took this incredibly personally, and Britney is in a position where she's on Instagram. She is not putting out music, but the narrative of the last few years is still like trailing her a little bit. And this sort of seems like an extension of the tragedy part of that narrative. But I wonder, do you think there's like a corner turn?
I don't know. I think anytime you put Britney in front of paparazzi cameras, which are now everybody's cameras, it's going to be fraught. And depending on how closely you're paying attention to her post-conservatorship life, there have been bumps. There's footage of her crying at a restaurant, reports of X, Y, and Z with her sons. We like to tell ourselves as a public that we've learned a lesson in terms of how we treat Britney from 2007 and other largely female stars of her caliber.
Yeah.
And yet, here we are in this cycle where it's happening over and over again. And now we're dragging a 19-year-old NBA player into it. So I don't, you know, it doesn't make me feel good, put it that way.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS, not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
All right, should we pivot to something maybe equally tendentious?
Yeah.
I feel like there's not a lot of like optimism on this. There's not a lot of joy going on so far.
That's what the snacks are for.
We're getting to that. We're arriving. Taylor Swift, Speak Now, re-recordings.
Taylor's version.
I'm going to do 20 seconds on the re-recordings. They're inessential. Not necessary. And in this case, causing a problem with the historical timeline.
Say more.
On one of these songs, Better Than Revenge, there is a lyric that has been changed. Now, I understand we are in a time of cultural evolution, evolving sensitivities, some might say devolving sensitivities, but there is a line on the original song targeted at I don't know whom, but people have their theories about an actress, and the line is... She's better known for things that she does on the mattress.
Which rhymes with actress.
It does.
Yeah.
That line did not survive to 2023. That didn't make it. What did make it is he was a moth to the flame. She was holding the matches.
Whoa.
Okay. So a couple things here. The first line's better.
Sure.
Almost always the case. First line's better. Second thing is it changes the meaning. And look, I'm not saying songs can't be living things. I'm not saying you can't evolve. I was interviewing someone recently who was talking about performing songs that were initially written or recorded 10, 15 years prior. And the natural instinct that he had to change things, to change references, outmoded references, like things that were newsy at the time or temporally specific to try to update them. Obviously all that happened. But when you are re-recording and you are saying that this is the canonical version of something.
It's supposed to replace the original.
And it does in fact replace the original.
Which the numbers have backed up with the other re-records.
And it's a whitewashing. If you were that person at that time,
18, 19 years old.
Yes. And I'm not saying you can't have personal
Victor Wembanyama age.
I'm not saying you can't grow, evolve, change personally, but I forgive me, I'm old fashioned, but it's like you're fudging with the historical record a little bit. And I understand like every artist has the right to present or be received in the way to present themselves in the way that they see most fit in keeping with their emotional, spiritual, psychological evolution. I get that. It does feel off to me when people are like correcting for old stuff. Now, this happens. Beastie Boys, yada, yada, yada. Everybody's, you know, like people just being like, hey, who I used to be, I'm not that person anymore. That said, when you're performing songs, when you're resharing songs, there is a little something where you're not giving the exact right thing unless you have trained your fans to expect the new thing, not the old thing. And that's the underlying thing going on here.
Here's what I think.
Retraining the fans.
Here's what I think is happening with the Taylor Swift re-records that addresses your big picture point, which is that the Taylor's versions are unnecessary and exhausting. It might be a term for them. And also the changing of the lyric, which is that the re-records are doing two things at once. They are giving Taylor Swift control of her masters, which, yes, as we all know, Scooter Braun bought via the label Big Machine, then flipped for more money, reportedly. So they're giving her control over these new recordings,
yes,
but they are also exposing new Taylor Swift fans who were not born when Speak Now came out to the songs, in many cases, for the first time. Mm-hmm. So they're working on two timelines.
Yes.
And I think that what she's doing in fixing correcting this anti-feminist slight, mm-hmm. which, to say nothing of the fact that the whole song is about how an evil woman stole her boyfriend.
This is what I'm saying. You can't undo the song. You can undo the word or the line, but you can't undo the song.
It feels like a gesture to me. It feels because the song is maybe not in keeping with her current politics. Here's a little Band-Aid, which will show, it's a wink to say, I know it wasn't cool to do this, but here, this is me trying, as Taylor might wow. say. But I also think it's funny because the real historical parallel to me is with a band that has been opening for Taylor on the Eras Tour with Paramore. And Paramore's maybe best known song, Misery Business, is very similar in both sound and subject matter to this. Taylor is a known Paramore fan, and it's about a homewrecker, right? Second chances, they don't never matter. People never change. What's a whore? You're nothing more. I'm sorry, that'll never change. And about forgiveness, we're both supposed to have exchange. Sorry, honey, but I pass it up. Now look this way. There was a time when Paramore said, we are no longer going to play our biggest defining song in concert because it's anti-feminist. Lo and behold, Paramore takes a few years off. The pandemic happens. Come back out on tour.
I sell tickets, baby.
And now, before they play Misery Business, which, spoiler, they play Misery Business, Haley gives a speech about, we thought, you know, we said in an interview, blah, blah, blah. We got cornered into this belief. And then we realized, like, you know, we might not be the same people we were when we wrote this song, but Misery Business is a banger.
And also, like, but can I
add? And then they play Misery Business.
But can I add something that, who owns a song? The author slash performer or the fans? What if Misery Business means something to me as a fan
yep.
that it doesn't mean to Paramore? I'm not saying Paramore can't make the choice to not play that song. It's obviously it's completely within the
balance. And Taylor doesn't play better than Revenge, for what it's worth.
Not yet.
Yeah, but it's not part of her repertoire in the past 10 years.
But on some level, you have to acknowledge that these songs function in ways with an audience that are far greater and far less knowable than the individual moment of, I wrote this song, it means this to me. And are you a performer that privileges, I have this one-to-one relationship with these three verses and two hooks? Or do these millions of people, in Taylor's case, that have a relationship with the song and want to hear something and take something from it, does that matter more than I grew up? We all grew up. I'm sure that there are songs that Taylor is playing on the Eras Tour that she also does not stand behind.
Yeah, the ones about being in love.
All wash, right? Why not change those? If those are as invalid, maybe they're not as politically invalid, but they may be emotionally invalid. I think when you've interviewed a number of people, and I'm sure this has come up, at a certain point when you're performing the song for the 5th, 10th, 50th, 100th time, there's a distance that forms between you and the song as the performer. Why was this lyric so beyond the pale? That distance was insufficient. I think you're right to say it's a wink, it's a nod. But if that's the case.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I don't love it.
Yeah, but if we're winking, I can probably list 10 other songs on the Eras Tour that probably could benefit from a wink.
Here's what I'll say about the re-record Taylor's version, Better Than Revenge. The lyric change is not the worst part of it. Her heart is not in it.
Yeah,
it doesn't and there's doesn't a hit. Certain there's a certain bratty bite to her vocals on Speak Now, specifically the first album that she wrote by herself, the first album she put out when she was super famous, the yep. first album post Kanye, mm-hmm. post her tabloid romances. And she had a real, there was youth. And there was attitude and there was edge to the way she performed a lot of these songs. Mean, the re-record, fine. There's songs on here where I don't miss the old Taylor necessarily, mm-hmm. but her heart is not in Better Than Revenge. The production is not there. It's just flat in a way that I've found almost none of the other Taylor's versions are. And I think it comes from this baggage and it comes from Taylor wanting to always self-correct.
And imagine how that's going to play out on the first album, like when she does the first, the self-titled. Like, how is that going to play out?
And I think,
how do you genuinely, yes. as a person who will be in your mid-30s, how do you plausibly revisit work that you did when you were 16 years old And either, frankly, to me, both options are not good. The option where you're trying to nail that tone, you're not going to get it right. And the option where you're like, the hell with that, I'm going to reinvest it with the wisdom of the ages, that's going to sound wrong.
There's already a lyric change on the self-titled. You remember this?
Oh, yes. That's right. On eBay, you can find versions of the first album. You can find. Should we say what it is?
Yeah, I think we have to. On Picture to Burn, a single from Taylor Swift's first album, there's a lyric about telling her friends that you're gay.
Crazy dance, but I'll tell mine you're gay. Obviously, this is a song written about
a breakup,
someone who has broken her heart. And the lyric, the original lyric is, go and tell your friends that I'm obsessive and crazy. I'll tell mine you're gay.
Can't say that.
No, you shouldn't have said that then. You can't say it now. Just that's
Katy Perry has a song that's very similar, except it's the whole song.
Yeah, also not great. This was always a little bit off. Subsequent pressings of this album changed this lyric. I forget exactly what it's changed to, but it changed this lyric. I have seen numerous TikToks in the last year of people finding this album at Goodwills or thrift stores, taking it home to see if it's the version that has this lyric. It has a little bit of collector's items, maybe not the right way to phrase it, but right. It has a little bit of the true Taylor fans. They hunt this out.
Yeah.
Or maybe the true Taylor enemies, the true ops hunt this out. But this has happened before. Now, look, this is an egregious lyric. This is not something that anybody should say. This was not right when it came out.
But it was the anger of a teenage girl. I'll say that.
Absolutely.
For both lyrics.
I totally agree. So you're right. There is precedent for this. I think this is a hateful lyric. The other lyric, it's a different line, it feels.
Okay.
Deleting and revising is always going to be messy business. But it's maybe not. It's maybe part of a Taylor ongoing narrative.
Yeah, I think what's really important to realize about her for close watchers, as they all know, and you can see it with the moves on the self-titled, is the antenna are up and she is constantly readjusting her public persona and her artistic persona to some respects. And this is something I actually love that she's sang about a lot. I referenced This Is Me Trying earlier. Mirrorball, I think, one of her greatest songs, mm-hmm. one of her most self-aware songs mm-hmm. about how she's always trying to reflect something back at people that they want from her. Mm-hmm. She needs the eyes on her and she needs them to all approve. Mm-hmm. And she's consistently updating her software, basically, to fix bugs.
13.2.1.
Yeah, yeah, 13. Did you do that on purpose?
Yes.
Yeah, that was good. And I think that she knew that this is the most loaded remaining lyric in her catalog. And that's why the fans were on high alert for the change, because they just had a sense that, knowing the type of person and artist that Taylor is, she wasn't just going to let this one lie, even though the rest of the re-records have been pretty spot on with a word change here or there.
Sure.
One thing she did for this re-record, which she didn't do notably for Red, was to send out a missive to say to her fans,
yeah,
please be nice to my ex.
Yeah. And also, I mean, look, it's striking as someone who's been on the receiving end of some hostility from Taylor Swift fans. It's striking that Taylor has historically not openly messaged to fans, be nice.
In fact, she's done the opposite, which is say, Scooter Braun, Bomb and Masters.
Go for it. Yeah.
Get Ithaca active. Partners and whoever their backers were financially.
Get active.
Go get them.
Right. And so it's striking that of all the times that this could have been a thing that Taylor or even Taylor's team was doing, that it didn't happen, that this is now the first time. And effectively, so she played Dear John. We talked about Dear John with the Olivia episode with Vampire. She played Dear John in Minneapolis maybe like a week and a half ago, but opened it by saying, I'm 33. I'm not upset about anything that may or may not have happened to me when I was 19 or at anybody who may or may not have done the thing that I may or may not have been upset. So basically, heal. Like, back
Stay
off.
Stay out of the comments.
Just let it be.
Jake Gyllenhaal was like, help.
But it's interesting because it is both. It is a command to not do something and also a command to do something all at the same time. It's a little like conductor. And that is consistent with what you were saying about the constant revision in the Taylor meta narrative.
Now, do you think she did this for people took it to be about John Mayer?
Yes.
Do you think she did this for John out of guilt about what happened to Jake because she got bad press for the way the fans attacked him, or some third unknowable reason? Like, what did you see as the intent here?
I'm going to say some third unknowable thing. And the reason I say that actually has less to do with the specifics of it and has to do with the casualness of what she said and how she said it. I was struck by how unformed the thought was. If you read the full transcript, if you watch the video.
As we lead up to this album coming out, I would love for that kindness and that gentleness to extend onto our internet activities. Right?
It's not nearly as linear as like the pull quotes would make you think. It's a little rangy. It goes in a few different places. It doesn't sound that workshopped, to be honest. And so I feel like it's some third thing. I will say, Dear John, one of my favorite songs, Taylor or otherwise, great record, had not been played live more than a decade, I believe. There is some, I think, intuitive idea or intuitive understanding on her part that is going to be newsy in and of itself. It's the best possible promo for
the re-record. Yes.
It's counter to the changed lyric. I think it's how can we build positive goodwill off of the loudest possible positive thing on the re-record? How can we build that up? Maybe even knowing that there's like a potential negative thing hiding around the corner.
Can I present another theory?
You sure can.
I went down the rabbit hole.
Where we live.
Of the Swifty conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
This one has been bubbling for some years now, but in the shadows.
Yeah, sure.
There are some fans who believe that Dear John is not, in fact, about John Mayer at all.
I think the reason that Taylor Swift told people to go easy on John Mayer is because Dear John is not about John.
I can't take it.
But about the same man.
I can't take it.
Who is the subject of Love Story.
Okay. Allegedly.
All of this is alleged.
Alleged.
Some people are breaking down.
That should be the opening screen of Popcast Deluxe.
Allegedly.
It's allegedly. And it's also, I know it seems like we're trolling, but we're not.
This is guy Martin Johnson in an emo band called Boys Like Girls.
Mm-hmm. There's a theory online that Taylor was dating the Martin Johnson of the band Boys Like Girls.
Yep. She has a song, if people remember, on a Boys Like Girls album.
Mm-hmm. What, maybe was that her first
feature?
Outside. Yeah, was it her first feature?
Gotta be.
I feel like it was. I remember being very surprised by it when it came out, so I feel like it was probably the first thing she had done external.
Fans think, A, it's a little obvious that she put the subject's first name in the title of the song. Obviously, okay. A Dear John letter is a thing.
It's idiomatic.
Culture. But this guy's name is Johnson. And there's some timeline things that don't quite add up. The crux of the song is that she was 19. Some people say she didn't start dating John Mayer until she was 20. Again, 19, I'm not saying
19 rhymes better. 19 probably better musical. 20 doesn't really go with her.
I think she was also on a John Mayer album before she turned 20. We'll crunch the numbers on this. To me, the real giveaway, this has always been the giveaway. We discussed this last week. There are Mayer-esque blues guitar licks on Dear John. I think it's one of the only Taylor Swift songs to feature a guitar solo.
Yeah, it is unmistakable what the song is trying to do. But if she was playing 4D chess to distract from this other person by making it seem very blatant, I mean, then...
Or... Like Vampire Before It.
Just is what it is.
Could be a composite. Could be about no one. Could be fiction. That's why we love this stuff.
No, I like it because I don't think it's fiction. But anyway, I know what you mean. How about a change?
Yeah, change of pace. Let's swerve.
How about a change agent? How about a chameleon? How about a question of the week?
Let's go.
About someone. We just talked for 20 minutes about how Taylor Swift changed one lyric in one song from 15 years ago. Instead, let's talk about an artist who is ever changing. I'm talking Lil Uzi Vert. I'm talking the Pink Tape. I'm talking question of the week. Should we get into it?
Let's go.
All right.
What do we got?
First of all, the email, this is at popcastnytimes.com. Read the emails. The email subject, it's a little loaded. The Pink Tape problem. Okay. It's from Gabe Gill. And Gabe says, John and Joe, I've only done a few listens of Uzi's Pink Tape, but I have some thoughts, questions I'd love to get your takes on. Pink Tape feels like a continuation of Uzi's melodic trap style, explored in exciting new ways, mostly with production from Working on Dying, some of which pushes rap into somewhat new areas. However, there is a sprinkling of genre experiments that incorporate Big Ten crossover songs, such as System of a Down's Chop Suey and Eiffel 65's Blue. BB Rexha, David Guetta. Some of this music is undoubtedly fun, but muddies the mood board when the album also includes an ARCA credit. The collabs with Baby Metal goes, and Bring Me the Horizon also goes.
It's a good review.
Yeah, exactly. This is great. We just published this. Work better for me as songs, but both feel like Uzi was slotted into existing tracks from bands that they liked and failed to cohere with the rest of the 26-song album. We're going to get into this. I'm certainly not saying that pop music shouldn't be cheesy and referential, but for a few reasons, these juxtapositions felt odd in an unintentional way. Is this purposeful? Is Uzi just channeling things they actually like? Is genre bending over? Is every hit record from the past just perpetual clay for the studio killing of the future? Was David Guetta even in the studio?
Wow.
Yeah. Lots to unpack there.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to talk about Pink Tape. We're going to touch on a bunch of this. Maybe let's start with a kind of top line question. Is this a problem? It says the Pink Tape problem. That's the question. Yeah.
It's only a problem if you try to listen to Pink Tape front to back.
Or in any order, frankly.
Yeah, if you try to listen to 26 Lil Uzi Vert songs at once, your brain is slime.
You're definitely getting kicked out of high school. Definitely getting suspended.
You think a high schooler could sit still for 26 songs?
No, definitely not sit still for 26 songs. You can rage for 26 songs. I'm not sitting still.
I think
it's hard to sit still just talking about this Uzi record.
The idea that rappers, especially rappers putting out 26 song projects, we'll call them, instead of tapes or albums.
Right.
I just don't believe that this
is designed with that linearity in mind.
I think we've been talking about post album for so long. We are firmly there.
With a data dump, as I've said in other contexts.
It's a data dump. It's a playlist. It's a bunch of songs, but I don't think it's an album.
But okay. But is it an idea? Even if it's not slotted or programmed as an album in the classic sense, it's not Illmatic. Right?
It's definitely not Illmatic. For better and for worse.
Sure, but if Uzi were sitting right here, what would Uzi say the thematic or musical through line of this record?
I think this is interesting because Uzi is already now calling this an experimental tape, which I think is a knee-jerk reaction to backlash. Comments about how it's trash emoji instead of fire emoji. The other thing Uzi has done is announced their next project.
Already. I mean, it's been like 15 minutes.
Yeah, and this is something we see more and more, which is I'm going to put a bunch of stuff out there. If it's received as a classic album, then it's a classic album. Exactly. If people are like, man, this is messy, then it's a experimental tape and the next one's coming up.
And undoubtedly, Uzi has 500 songs in the chamber.
At least.
Okay. Pink Tape is Uzi's detox.
Sure.
It's just that for detox, it's a 15-year time frame before Dr. Dre says, actually, I'm not going to release Detox. For Uzi, Pink Tape is something that has been teased for a really long time, but really long time in Uzi time is 12 months?
A couple years.
18 months?
Yeah.
Right. So what ends up happening with artists like this and who are in constant dialogue with incredibly devoted pockets of fans is the narrative of an album is already set before the album is released. Mm-hmm. It's set because of the tone of the discourse. It's set because of snippets that leak.
A lot of snippets.
A lot of snippets.
A lot of leaks.
Lot for sure. But it's already set. So Uzi is releasing this album, and the most vociferous people are the people who have already thought about it, parsed it, theorized about it, philosophized about it before it was ever released. Those people are highly susceptible to being like, it's trash. It's not what I thought it was going to be. It has no bearing at all on what an average person, I mean, like, I care about Lil Uzi Vert, but I'm not in that group.
Right. You're not in academics' comments.
No, and I'm not in whatever discords, like the paid discords for the leaks. I'm not in, but I'm aware of that stuff. I just receive it as it's a new album. And as a new album, I like it better than the last Uzi album. I was actually really surprised at that first 12 to 24 hours of this ain't it. Because when I finally got around to listening to it, I was, no, this is a version of Uzi that I like.
I think that's the other thing is that Uzi exists to confound. And you hinted at this as we were going into the question. Whatever people thought Pink Tape was, Uzi's going to give you something left of that. Mm-hmm. And this album really works on those terms. You've never heard somebody interpolate Eiffel 65 with Nicki Minaj on one track, which sounds like it could be on the radio. Mm-hmm. And I mean that as a slight. And then
I like that song.
It's fine, Endless Fashion. And then the next song, Mama, I'm Sorry, interpolates both Gautier's Somebody I Used to Know and Hate Being Sober by Chief Keef. So you have.
Can we listen to that?
Yeah.
Let's listen a little bit. This is Mama, I'm Sorry. CC, still hate being sober. I cannot feel my body. I'm in the party. I'm up two shots
of Molly. I'm feeling awesome. Lead his way to the car. Uzi is giving us everything good about music right now and everything bad about music right now all at the same time. The references, the samples, the collaborations, the data dump. Mm-hmm. It's so much to parse through, but that's what being a Lil Uzi Vert fan is all about.
But also, I feel like I say this from time to time and it sounds insulting. It's not. It's absolutely modern. It's completely of the moment. Whatever great rap albums people are going to talk about this year, none of them are more 2023 than this record. This is an extraordinarily of the moment record in terms of the genre experiments, in terms of the messiness, in terms of the length, in terms of the mainstream quote unquote crossovery songs, in terms of the variety of rap flows, like stuff that's much more straightforward. What's the song towards the end? Is it Days Come and Go? That's like very personal.
And Rehab, another extremely personal one. You said you'll be okay,
Baby Metal?
Yeah, what do you make of the...
First of all, that Baby Metal record is...
Yeah, what do you make of the rock experiments here? Uzi, always been in conversation with rock.
Yeah, of course. And I think to Gabe's point, those songs do feel like songs that those bands, Bring Me the Horizon, Baby Metal, System of a Down. That's a sample, not a collaboration.
A cover?
I can't quite tell.
Is it AI? Uzi Wood.
Yes, System of a Down adjacent record. It does feel like Uzi slotting themselves into those kinds of styles. But is that radically different than the Uzi of 18 months ago, playing around with rock stuff? Just because Just Wanna Rock, obviously that's a huge hit from earlier this year, but did you really think you were going to get a tape of 15 versions of that song?
And even Jersey Club is something that Uzi was trying on.
It's all try-ons. But the thing is, when Uzi tries something on, as opposed to, say, Drake trying something on, there's something that Drake does when he's engaging other styles. It's very studious. It's like, how do I become the Drake version of Migos? How do I become the Drake version of something UK drill. Uzi is a lot less centered. I do think that there is a kind of consistent reimagining of what a Lil Uzi Vert song can sound like. And so I agree with the premise of the question, but I maybe disagree with the takeaway, because I did not listen to this record and think, ah, it failed to be centered. I listened to this record and thought, ah, it's exciting. It's so many different things. And I don't know that I want 15 of any one of these things, but I'm happy that there are, I don't know about 26, but I'm happy that there are 10 to 15 novel ideas moving on this album.
What's also interesting about it is that it's working. At least it will become the first number one album of the year that is mostly a rap album.
Sure.
And I wonder if it has legs, because one of the things that Uzi has been throughout their career against conventional wisdom is extremely popular. Think of EXO Tour Life, not originally supposed to be a single, one of the biggest singles of its time.
Yep.
Just Wanna Rock, not upon first listen a super palatable record, but somehow makes every 9 to 11 year old in the world do the same dance. So I wonder if Uzi, as they've done multiple times throughout their career, is going to happen upon a hit or three off of what they called an experimental tape.
Yeah, but you know how you happen on a hit is you try a whole bunch of different stuff. And I think if you are an artist like this, that is not like, again, we are still like relics of the album age, where we're sort of like, you're this person and this person. And even you look at Drake or Taylor, it's eras. Uzi is not functioning in eras. Uzi just firing missiles, firing darts every single direction. You just don't know. And if you do that, and if your artistic presence is flexible enough to accommodate 10 different kinds of experiments, you more than likely will stumble on the next thing way faster than an artist who's more established and frankly has much more to lose by experimentation. You need an Uzi to divine out what the next direction is so that the more established people can then hover and aggregate around it. That's what Uzi does. And that's why I think what they're doing is so interesting, because I don't see this as a record of the current moment. I see this as divination of what the next moment is going to be.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
You want to talk about experimental formalism in another medium?
Sure. Yes. Strong pivot.
You saw a movie.
I did. This
is happening more and more.
This is, I will say, like the perhaps the most surprising evolution for me personally of the last few weeks is I guess we're seeing movies now.
All right. And it's not only outside for Deluxe, although we will be talking movies on Deluxe.
Yes, we will be talking movies on Deluxe. But yeah, we're outside. We've seen movies.
Big summer.
If you say so. I have no summers to compare it to that were like 1992.
Wes Anderson's Asteroid City.
Woo! What do those pulses indicate?
What? Oh, the beeps and blips? We don't know.
Some of our information about outer space may no longer be completely accurate. Anyway, there's still only 9 planets in the solar system as far as we know, Billy.
Except now there's an alien.
What'd you think? What's your relationship to Wes Anderson in general?
I haven't seen anything since Rushmore.
Incredible.
Yeah. Like, I understand. Look, it's like one of those things where it's like, I acknowledge that's like a famous white director.
He is that.
Yeah. But like, it's just not a thing that I have made room for in my life.
Not a Fantastic Mr. Fox guy?
I couldn't identify it.
Stop motion animation. Doesn't seem like your thing.
I can tell. I've seen the poster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. George Clooney, Meryl Streep. Heard of him?
Are they in that?
Their voices.
Yeah, see, nah, I'm good. I'm good. Miss me with that.
So, okay. So as somebody who hasn't seen a Wes Anderson movie since he became a very different sort of director, a director known for these very tightly controlled dioramas, very these sort meticulous. Of story within yeah. a story, mm-hmm. Asteroid City is commenting on all of that.
Yeah.
What did it feel like to come to that cold?
Did you just use the word diorama?
Yes.
Yeah. That feels very, I felt like I was watching... I didn't feel like I was watching a movie so much as I was watching someone talking about the making of a movie. And then there is a visual representation of the thing that they are talking about. And obviously that is partially what the film is.
Right.
But I felt like even the meta film within that still felt small and being, it's imagine if the camera, this is the movie, but there's like some other angle on it. I felt like I was watching from the other angle, not from the direct camera.
Right. So the thing that you're hinting at is that Asteroid City is a play
that's with, what it
within the
to,
movie
yes.
being documented by a television crew in real time.
While also there's an overlay of conversation about the playwright and the character work separate from that. Color versus black and white. It's two different things happening at the same time.
And they say in the opening of the film that the play, in fact, doesn't exist, but is made up for the television program about the play.
Right.
So this is all this nesting doll of storytelling devices.
What's it really about, though?
I think it's about grief. I think it's about storytelling.
I did enough reading to know that all of them are about grief.
All of them are about grief, about family, about the sort of troop-like nature that it takes to find your creative partners and mm-hmm. make work with them. It's about making a movie in many ways, I think. But I agree with you that it was so layered with meta mm-hmm. irony and so tightly wound, again, on purpose, which mm-hmm. I think is supposed to reflect how hard it is for these characters to get in touch with their emotions.
Yeah.
The story circles around a war photographer whose wife has died and his four children and him telling them the bad news.
Right.
I couldn't get there. Like, it didn't emotionally, which like most of his movies do work for me on that level.
But it's funny because I felt like I wasn't supposed to get there emotionally. That actually was striking, that you felt like you couldn't get there and that was a bad thing. I felt what I was being told was that you're not, because Jason Schwartzman's character is such a failure emotionally, that you're not supposed to feel like you get there.
But I think eventually, like, there are a few scenes near the end, the scene between Jason Schwartzman and Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing about this movie. Every actor you've ever heard of, every great living actor mm-hmm. for half a line or the yep. whole film. I think that scene. And then again, the scene between him and Margot Robbie, her one scene on the balcony where she plays the woman who was supposed to play his wife but was yeah. written out of the film. And they have this moment of not quite connection where I think there is supposed to be a little bit of catharsis.
But to me, the catharsis is, and the difference, because I feel like you're seeing two different, we've seen a lot of different movies, you're seeing two different layers of narrative. You're seeing the adults and you're seeing the children.
Yes.
And when you're watching the teenagers who are all finalists for some kind of science prize. That's right. The premise. And they've all gathered in the middle of the desert at some remote military base to show off their inventions and to win a check for it's like the Westinghouse prize or whatever. I think that's been renamed the Intel prize or whatever. What you're seeing in the kids, obviously you're seeing direct access to emotion. You see it in the, is it Ricky? Ricky Cho's character, when he's like fighting back against when they're in quarantine, he's like pushing back against them. You see it in the emotional connection between Schwartzman's son, Scarlett Johansson's daughter, Woodrow, and Dina. This hope for a love that transcends the kind of ordinary pains that their parents' generations are grappling with. There's also something in there about American ambition and this generation, the younger generation, representing some kind of eye on the sky, futurism, willingness to engage broadly, not scared of the alien that comes, spoiler, whereas the parents' generation is tight and uncertain of how to navigate emotionally or even politically the teenagers generation is willing and open. And I think to me that if there was an emotional through line that really resonated for me, it was everything that was happening with the 14-year-olds or the 15-year-olds.
And that's another big running theme through all of Anderson's filmography, which
if
is
you say so.
Parents messing up their children, the sort of the loss of innocence yep. and trying to basically outrun the curses of your absent or deceased parents. Yeah. Did you find this movie funny at all? Because the thing with me with later Wes Anderson is that I often am saying that's funny instead of laughing, or yeah. that's nice mm-hmm. instead of yeah. like a happy tear. You know what I mean? It's like mm-hmm. it can't get me all the way there. And I wonder how, if you giggled at all.
I didn't find it funny, but I will say I had a genuinely hilarious experience watching this movie. I saw it at BAM. Maybe there's 30 people in the theater. It was one individual laughing, guffawing so intensely at, dare I say, wrong moments. And maybe I'm not the target audience. Maybe I just don't know what the funny part of the Wes Anderson movie is. But to me, the funniest part of watching this movie was reacting to this individual absolutely losing it at the strangest moments, loudly, like in a...
I've had this experience a lot.
Out of control.
Post-pandemic.
And I every time that individual lost it, 4 seconds later, I'm losing it as well, but not because of what's happening on the screen. I also feel like the nature of the humor in a Wes Anderson, this is like not humor that speaks to me necessarily.
You're a no hard feelings kind of guy.
You know how it is.
You got a song of the week?
Boy, do I. Should we get into it?
Let's go.
All right. There was a call, I think it was in the YouTube comments, for some conversation about New Jeans. New Jeans. I like New Jeans.
I'm slacking on New Jeans. Where do I start?
Okay, first of all, we got to start with Cookie. That's the 1.0 New Jeans. I mean, we're not that far. What are we, like 9 months removed? I mean, it's like, this is moving very fast. There are a number of K-pop girl groups that have popped up in the last 12 months, post-Blackpink. And I don't mean post-Blackpink as a group so much as a phenomenon. New Jeans, Le Sserafim, 50/50. To me, New Jeans is the best because whoever's handling their production, I like them as singers, but whoever's handling them production has a really forward-sounding ear when it comes to beat selection, when it comes to references. There's little flashes of New Jersey Club. This record, this new one, it's called Super Shy. It's like light neo drum and bass, maybe a tiny bit of club undertow. I like the lyrics. I like the coyness. There was also this thing with the early New Jeans song where if you read it maybe through an American lens, it felt a little bit more salacious than it was suggested it was in Korean. It seems to me that they are playing with that tension of maybe how a foreign audience might receive some of the lyrics differently from how they might be received inside in Korea. And so it feels a little like winky in a way, but it's also, if you choose to receive it as like purely saccharine and purely sweet, you can also do that. But the song is called Super Shy. New Jeans maybe has 10 songs out now. I think they're batting 700, 800. Really good. No notes. I'm super shy, super shy, but wait a minute while I'm making
sit on top, looking pretty. Follow me, 우리 둘이 나란히 보이지? 내 눈이 갑자기 빛나지? When you say I'm a dream. What do you got? I got a little Southern rap song for you.
Atlanta?
Not Atlanta. The thing about this song is, it sounds like it could be Atlanta.
This is like a recurring theme.
Yes, this yeah. is my favorite kind of music is music from the Deep South. That sounds like it's of Atlanta, but it's not quite of Atlanta.
Okay. All
this right. is Alabama's Rilo Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. His album Been One came out the week before last. It's been long awaited. This is an artist who thrives outside of, let's say, the major systems. Big on YouTube.
Yeah.
A lot of uncleared samples. A lot of leaks. Great rapper. extremely slurry.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But also extremely lyrical. Mm-hmm. This is an artist who...
Definitely slurry.
This is an artist with a very thick Southern accent and marble mouth delivery, but who, once you parse that, you realize is obsessed with wordplay and puns.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of threads going around Twitter right now about favorite Rilo bars, because this is something you don't get a lot in modern rap music, which is...
rappity rap stuff, but hiding out underneath
melodic
stuff.
And jokes, really.
Detroit.
Yeah, it is in conversation with a lot of Detroit music happening right now. And on this song, one of my favorites from the new album, it's called Free Game, and there's a Skip Bayless joke on here.
I know who that is.
I'm impressed. There's a lot to discover if you spend time with Rilo's music. And he's really having a huge moment, which is not necessarily something you would expect from an artist that sounds like he does. I think when we came in to record, his album was like number 2 on Apple Music after Taylor Swift, debuted at number 10 on the charts. This is a cult artist who I think is crossing over into a more mainstream space, which is a fascinating development.
Honey, I'm still innocent, but he just came home, but I got cases still pending. Put you in your body, I can see your judges getting dangerous. Soon you miss that game, wanna watch them bleachers get empty. Can't believe we made it, talk to my dad, say moving Houston, soon he leave Vegas. And I got bros who locked up waiting to get reinstated.
You hungry?
Always.
Even with your cleanse?
So I am still eating mostly healthy, but I had some birthday cake over the weekend, so I'm prepared for
whatever this might be.
The snack of the week.
All right, let's go to the cupboard.
We're going sweet or savory?
We're going savory. Okay. So as we have said, Joe is a committed snackhead. I am a committed snackhead. I remember 3 or 4 months ago at my corner spot, I picked up the corn flavor of this and the vanilla flavor of this. I sent you pictures like, yo, I got something. And your immediate response was basically like, had that.
Yeah, been there.
Been there.
Yeah.
Have you had turtle chips truffle flavor?
I have not had the truffle flavor. I've had the one that's like chocolate churro. It's like chocolate and cinnamon.
Yes.
That is honestly one of the most delicious snacks I've ever had in my life. Mm-hmm. I forget who put me on to turtle chips. I think I saw them on Instagram somewhere. Not sponsored, never sponsored.
Never sponsored.
But it just an unbelievable combination of texture and flavor. And I'm not normally a truffle guy, but I'm interested to try this.
So on the back, it says truffle flavor. This snack, composed of 4 crunchy layers, harmonizes and blends in the flavor of truffle salt.
Let's go.
Those fans, longtime fans of truffles, will remember the MIA Lynn Hirschberg kerfuffle of many years ago. I wonder if instead of truffle fries, if truffle turtle chips were at play, maybe it wouldn't have gone so crazy.
It's true. This has a real high-low thing going
on. That's what I'm saying. Truffle fries is tough, but truffle turtle chips. Oh, the smell. Wow. Okay. I'm not going to lie. It smells like Domino's pizza.
Great.
Just put like whiff it up. It smells like when you first opened the box.
Oh, yeah. Phenomenal. Little sweet, little salty. Deep flavor.
I wish it held the crunch a tiny bit longer.
See, that's actually what I love about turtle chips is the fragileness.
It congeals really fast, but like, I wish it was like a tiny bit crisper.
Mm. Yeah. I could go through this whole bag.
Yeah. I mean, we might be about to. Look at my guy. Look at the turtle. Look at that truffle salt. First of all, you want to talk about people out here bawling? My guy is he's not skimping.
He's not stingy with the truffle salt.
Exactly. He comes to the side of the table. He's doing tableside truffle salt. You just keep going. Come on. No price.
Turtle chips are undefeated. This is a 9 out of 10 for me.
I really didn't love the corn flavor, to be honest, but vanilla I thought was good. Yeah, I'm going to go 8.5 on this. Really good. Would buy again. and might just have these at the house permanently. Come over to the crib. We'll lock it in.
Gonna have to order a case. I'm gonna cleanse my palate with an apple.
That seems terrible. I wouldn't do that. Is that our show?
It's our show.
Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Podcast Deluxe is on YouTube. Podcast Regular, anywhere you get your audio content, that would be Apple, that would be Spotify, and also on YouTube on the New York Times audio channel. Podcast Deluxe is on the main New York Times YouTube channel. Get involved with us. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Any questions, as you see, we will be talking about them on air. Leave a comment on one of the videos. We'll read that.
Send us a snack.
Send us a snack. Send us a recommendation or an actual snack. Get in the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. It's tinyurl.com/podcastfacebook or podcast Discord. The t-shirts and the stickers are at itsthepopcast.myshopify.com. As always, thank you to Karen Gantz. Thank you to Pedro Rosado. We are produced this week by Leslie Davis with help from Sawyer Roque. We will be back next week.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.